Hello and welcome to another episode of Twimmel Talk, the podcast where I interview interesting people doing interesting things in machine learning and artificial intelligence. I'm your host, Sam Charrington. If you're listening to this podcast, you've likely seen some of the press coverage and discussion surrounding the release, or lack thereof, of OpenAI's new GPT-2 language model. The announcement caused quite a stir, with reactions spanning confusion, frustration, concern, and many points in between. Several days later, many open questions remain about the model and the way the release was handled. Seeing the continued robust discourse and wanting to offer the community a forum for exploring this topic with more nuance than Twitter's 280 characters allow, we convened the inaugural Twimmel Live panel. I was joined on the panel by Amanda Askell and Miles Brundage of OpenAI, Anima Anandkumar of NVIDIA and Caltech, Robert Monroe of Lilt, and independent AI researcher Stephen Merity, with Anima, Robert, and Stephen being some of the most outspoken voices in the online discussion of this issue. Our discussion thoroughly explored the many issues surrounding the GPT-2 release controversy. We cover the basics like what language models are and why they're important, and why this announcement caused such a stir, and dig deep into why the lack of a full release of the model raised concerns for so many. The panel initially aired via YouTube Live, and we're happy to share it with you via the podcast as well. To be clear, both the panel and live stream format were a bit of an experiment for us, and we'd really love to hear your thoughts on it. Would you like to see or hear more of these Twimmel Live conversations? And if so, what issues would you like us to take on? If you have feedback for us on the format, or if you'd like to join the discussion around OpenAI's GPT-2 model and its release, head over to the show notes page for this show at twimmelai.com/talk/234 and leave us a comment. If you're a new listener and you like what you hear, be sure to hit that subscribe button in your podcast app. And now, on to the show. Everyone, welcome to the first Twimmel Live, where we'll be talking about OpenAI's recent GPT-2 language model release and announcement and controversy, and exploring the host of issues that it raises. I am Sam Charrington, your host for the discussion. For those of you who may have stumbled across this and are not familiar with This Week in Machine Learning and AI, it is a podcast that I launched coming up on 3 years ago that's really dedicated to informing and educating people about machine learning and artificial intelligence. And I've been fortunate to have very many wonderful guests, including several of our panelists today. You can find the podcast easily at twimmelai.com. So before we dive into our discussion, I'd like to give our panelists an opportunity to introduce themselves. Anima, why don't you get us started?
Hi, I'm Anima Anandkumar. I'm Director of Machine Learning Research at NVIDIA, as well as a professor at Caltech. So thank you, Sam, for doing this. I think, you're always like looking at the pulse of the community, and this is a topic that has garnered a lot of recent interest and thought process. So thanks for doing this, and I'm happy to be part of this. I do want to make a clarification that these are my personal comments. They may very well coincide with my employers, but I'm not assigned to be speaking on their behalf in this particular instance.
Awesome. Thank you. Amanda?
Hi, I'm Amanda Askell. I'm a policy research scientist at OpenAI. My background is actually in ethics, since working on all areas related to like policy here.
Awesome. Miles?
My name is Miles Brundage, and I'm also on the policy team at OpenAI. My background is more in social science and tech policy, and I have a particular interest in malicious uses of AI and was involved in a report last year on the topic. So it's part of my interest here.
Awesome. Rob?
Hey everyone, I'm Rob Monroe. I'm a VP of product at Lilt. Lilt makes technology that combines human and machine translation. My background is mixed. I've been a founder and executive at a number of AI startups. In larger companies, I ran product for AWS's first natural language processing and translation services. And before I moved here to the US to get a PhD in NLP at Stanford, I was working in post-conflict development in Sierra Leone and Liberia for the United Nations. And I've continued to work in disaster response, both for man-made and natural disasters since then.
Great. And Stephen.
Hi, I'm Stephen Merity, most commonly known on the internet as Smerity. And I'm an independent AI researcher, but the primary reason I'm interesting here is that I focus on language modeling as my research area. And I've held state-of-the-art results on some of the same results as OpenAI AI's model. And two of the data sets that they get state-of-the-art results on are on mine.
Awesome. Awesome. So let's dive right in. And given your focus on this area, Stephen, you would be a great person to kind of provide some context for us. What is a language model and, you know, how are they used? Why are they important? And what's the kind of context, the technical context in which this announcement was made?
Right. So language modeling, for anyone who hasn't run across it yet, if you have your phone out and you're doing your normal typing, the predictive keyboard is essentially the time you'll run into a language models the most. So the aim is just to guess the next word in your sequence. But then you can, of course, go for some more complicated steps along. Rather than guessing words, you could guess characters or tokens. But yeah, the underlying technology is literally just guess the next token in the sequence, whatever the sequence might be. And so you've most likely run into it with your phone, but it's also used in speech recognition to disambiguate certain words. So the word recognition itself could be wreck the ignition of a car, theoretically, or it could be, speech recognition. So it's used there. It's also used in a number of other situations in similar contexts, or abstract summarization and so on. But most recently, the kind of really interesting step has been that these incredibly complex language models, if you run them over enough data, can basically capture a bunch of subtasks that you don't ask it to capture by just guessing the next word, but it might end up learning that anyway. So things like counting in certain models, we never tell them how a model is supposed to count, but it ends up doing that to be able to guess text. And you can then take this model and slot it into a more complex system where it kind of this knowledge that it's already gotten just to be able to guess the next word in the sequence well ends up transferring to these other tasks. So things like sentiment analysis or question answering or translation.
Awesome. And so there are some standard tests, it sounds like, that are used to kind of assess the performance of language models. What are some of these tests?
Yeah. So the the absolute standard is something called perplexity, which is basically how confused is a language model when you tell it what the next token is. So if you're guessing and you say New York and you're going to guess the next word and you say city, if I said New York State, maybe I'm not that confused by it because I was thinking that as well, but usually it's city. Versus if you came up with New York static or something like that, some completely unexpected word, then you'll see the perplexity spike. So basically, the only aim for language modeling is to minimize how confused the model is at having seen like a given sequence. And so that's kind of the metric that OpenAI focus on and kind of all these previous papers have as well.
Okay. And so Miles and Amanda, this work with GPT-2 is, as the two indicates, the second in a series of research into language models. Can you talk a little bit about the background of this project as well as the type of model specifically that it represents, namely transformer models?
Yeah, so I mean, we've been interested in sort of unsupervised learning of useful representations of text for a while, and the sentiment neuron paper or a blog post, I believe a year or two ago, was an example of sort of early interest at OpenAI and the first GPT paper as well. The main difference in terms of GPT-2 versus previous transformer-based language models is scale. So it's not the biggest language model that's ever been produced, but is, as far as we know, it's the best performing model along various metrics, including the quantitative ones, as well as sort of qualitative assessment of the quality of long text production. And specifically in terms of like size, the range is, from millions to billions of parameters. And the one that we have chosen not to release is 1.5 billion. So there have been bigger language models previously, but what's interesting here is that there's a very diverse data set being used to produce it and make use of this larger capacity of the model. And the GPT sort of model is easier to sample from than say BERT or other recent efforts to sort of push language modeling beyond this scale.
And the specific type of model is a transformer model. What does that represent?
I think probably Smarity would be a better person to answer that.
Okay, so the transformer model, many of the audience might have heard of like recurrent neural networks, so RNNs and LSTMs, that type of thing. The idea with that would be, imagine you could only see one word on a page at a time, and you only had one button, which was to go to the next word. So that's the way the LSTM or recurrent neural network ends up looking at text and trying to guess the next word. And the problem with that is, I don't know about the rest of the panelists, but my memory is terrible. So about 10 words in, I'll have forgotten what everything was behind that. The idea with the transformer network is instead of having this, step along one at a time, you say, okay, I have 100 words and I'm trying to guess the next word. The word at the very end can basically talk to all of the words previous to it and try and pull in some of their knowledge based on whether or not, I should be essentially talking to you. So if I'm about to say, the last word is president, I might look back the last 100 words, and I might find some other exact instances of president. So a good idea there would be just to grab the next word along. Or you might do something more complicated where multiple words kind of have to chat to each other. And so that's the idea of this attention phase where words can look around at other words based on how interesting they are to that given word. And you go through multiple stages of this. And hopefully at the end, all of kind of the relevant knowledge from this sequence will be captured in the very word at the end. And that word can go, cool, I was going to say, Obama or Trump or Nixon or something like that.
So a big part of the controversy, I suppose, with the release of this model was, not so much the research itself and the technical details, but kind of the way the model was released. Rob, I'm wondering if you can maybe provide some context from your perspective, just reflecting on the release and the firestorm that it created, at least in Twitter. I don't want to over amplify it. Twitter can be a bit of an echo chamber, as we all know. But what's your take on, some of the things that were maybe controversial about the announcement?
Yeah, happy to. And Miles and Amanda, correct me if I'm characterizing OpenAI wrong. So I believe that OpenAI decided not to make this model public, which is something that's been standard recently in the research community. And the reason behind this was because the potential negative use cases outweighed the positive ones. So you could get bad actors who could use a model like this to, for example, generate fake news, which stylistically sounded very much like a real person. And so it could be used for things like election meddling or generally creating discontent on the internet, both by individual trolls or potentially state-sponsored. So is that correct, OpenAI folk?
Yeah, I mean, one thing I'd clarify is that we did not claim, nor are we confident that the negative uses of GPT-2 would outweigh the risks, but rather that we're not confident that they wouldn't, and that this is sort of what seems to us like a sort of precautionary approach in this context of given the sort of irreversibility of release. Do you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, no, this sounds correct. So I think it's easy to think that you have to have like really high confidence that what you're releasing is going to have negative consequences before you decide to at least do a partial release. I think our thought was that caution early is a good plan, and then to try and get feedback on this approach. So it might be that, one criticism might be that this is kind of like too preemptive or too early. And I think it's just that the costs of starting to think about these things early are generally lower than the costs of thinking about them too late when you are fairly confident that the misuse risk is high. So this was like some of the kind of reasoning that went behind this. And then, as Miles said, deciding to do a partial release is reversible, whereas deciding to do a full release is not reversible. So exercising caution can mean initially doing a partial release. And that was what we decided to do.
Okay. Yeah, I guess that's a very fair distinction. Not yet knowing rather than being confident that it was necessarily bad. Yeah. And so this is like certainly a decision process that I've had to go through many times in the past. In disaster response during the Arab Spring in particular, thinking about what kinds of data were being collected and how, for example, if you take a tweet of someone reporting a blocked road, they don't know why it's blocked, but then all of a sudden you recontextualize that and you're reporting that there are rebel movements in an area. And now that the rebels know that you've reported them. So you have to be very careful about taking other people's data and releasing that. And certainly, building a model on open data like OpenAI did, and then re-releasing that counts as recontextualizing. Similarly, I've seen every form of propaganda, broadcast radio through to social media, used in Sierra Leone and Liberia, countries that I used to live in, and I've worked in election monitoring during their elections there. And even when there weren't state-sponsored actors made decisions like this. So when I was responding to the earthquake in Haiti in 2010, and since released data which machine learning scientists can build on, we deliberately omitted all the data which reported unaccompanied minors, children who are alone. For this very reason, we believed that the potential negative use cases were something we couldn't protect well for. And so this wasn't something that we wanted to make available. So I appreciate that decision process. To characterize the outcry, I think that there's two aspects to it. One, at least me, I didn't see the context in how this decision was made. It felt a little bit buried in the paper, and it probably deserved more space in the article. Hopefully I'm preaching to the converted because we've got OpenAI's ethics people here, not their, their machine learning people. And I think the other, which is less for me to speak about, I don't call myself a practicing researcher now, is that the paper very proudly reported new state-of-the-art results for a model that wasn't then immediately available to the research community to replicate.
Yeah, can I add one point on sort of the norm that you mentioned around openness? I think it's important to sort of be clear that it was not the case that before this, everyone always released all their state-of-the-art models all the time. It's rather that it was rarely it was rarely the case that people would explicitly use sort of misuse of the model of the sorts and of the sorts that we're worried about as a justification, as opposed to profit or keeping things under wrap in order to have a big announcement or something like that. So it's the motivation for non-release that I think is distinctive, as opposed to that we didn't publish everything.
Was there a big recent paper in language modeling where they didn't release? So I'm thinking of the big recent ones, kind of in reverse chronological order, being Laser from Facebook, Bert from Google, and Elmo from Allen Institute. I believe they all released their models. Are there others I'm not aware of?
Yeah, so I was speaking more about AI generally. It might be the case that there's more of a tendency towards publication in the language model literature specifically.
Right.
And so part of the issue that this raises is around reproducibility, and I'm sure we'll come back to that in the conversation. Anima, you've also raised some issues around the kind of the way it's been handled from just a reporting and media relations perspective. Can you elaborate on those?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly understand that it's important to think about malicious use cases and all the impact of releasing a certain technology, right? So I'm appreciative of the thought process that goes into the risk analysis. But as Miles pointed out, that's never been the reason for not releasing a language model before. So that's, suddenly like where the new risk is coming up that didn't come up with the earlier models, which are nearly as good, if not as good. And also the claim that this is much better than the previous models is not even something the research community has verified or can easily verify without access to the models. So there is the issue of like truly understanding what the capabilities of the most recent model are and having independent researchers evaluate that effectiveness. And before all that's done, it felt like the media was at the center stage of all this, right? And the access was only given to journalists and in a very limited way to write articles for the public. So before it reached the research community, before there was any chance to evaluate its technical capabilities, there was these huge media blitz on, the Terminator coming. It's gotten so dangerous that AI needs to be locked up in a vault. These kind of articles, promoted a lot of fear mongering that's already been present in some of these general media articles. And that's where this distortion of the scientific facts and the current capabilities that I have big issues with.
Okay. And another issue that's been raised along the lines of the reproducibility concern has been one about open source and the model's source code being open. Stephen, is that one that you have a thought on?
Yeah. So the idea that model being open, that's been a pretty popular idea for many of the AI research labs. As Miles mentioned, it isn't the default. There are many kind of papers that don't publish their models or don't publish their code. But one of the main ideas behind kind of this entire field is the open nature of our work. You publish the papers on the archive, there's no payment to get the paper. The techniques are generally very well known by everyone involved, and there are free toolkits or frameworks. And to this stage, Google's collaboratory or what have you, they can give you free GPUs. This is a great idea because, basically anyone can get involved. If someone would like to, they could take OpenAI's language model or, one from Google or NVIDIA and test and see how it works, potentially use it for other applications. So open reproducible research, it kind of hits all those lines down, whether or not someone can take the model and improve it, whether they can take it to use it for an interesting application, whether they can just explore the current capabilities as, maybe a researcher trying to understand the latest advances. And at some point I'll come back to kind of my also perspective on, I love the kind of discussion and the OpenAI model itself. I'm, always interested in language modeling research. But I feel like one issue is that everything kind of came together. It was a new language model. It was discussions about responsible disclosure, how journalists react to AI research and publication, and then how the general media consumes it. I think that was one of the main things kind of powering this confused firestorm on Twitter and potentially in media.
Yeah, Amanda and Miles, you're shaking your heads. We agree. Thoughts from you?
Like, there's a lot of points being raised. I think one thing, I just want to go back to a point that was made earlier, where there's this kind of question of like, well, it's like, we've seen lots of really impressive language models before. The way that this was presented was as if this is some kind of like change in kind, what's this new risk that's arising that wasn't arising before? And I think on this, one thing that's worth noting is just that if machine learning is an area where you see incremental progress, one concern you might have is the point at which it makes sense to do something like partial disclosure of research is always going to kind of look like the wrong point, because it's going to be this sudden shift from full disclosure of models in the case of like language models to like a partial release, like what we did here. But if it's the case that you always just have these like incremental improvements, and this is like an example of it, there might not be some huge shift. It might not be that you saw some like completely new potential misuse. It's just that at some point you have to make the decision. So I guess I want to say like we weren't intending to imply that it was like something that it wasn't. I think we were very explicit in the blog post and in the paper about like the nature of the research and where it sat in relation to other research. But it's hard to convey that while also deciding that you're going to do a slightly different release type from what's happened before.
Yeah, I mean, we did try and, you know, be clear that we were talking both about, you know, GPT-2 as well as language models in general, but I think we could have been a lot clearer about sort of what are the threats of GPT-2 mm-hmm. raw versus GPT-2 fine-tuned versus, you know, GPT-3 or, you know, someone reproducing it. So, and like, what are the sort of, you know, domains or skill levels required for these different things? So this is something that we plan to be a lot more transparent about in the future, about like, why would we do this and what are the trade-offs involved and sort of, you know, what were the options we considered and why did we not do the things that people are saying, yeah, we should do now.
Anima, you're reacting to this.
I think I am kind of worried when it's, you know, when Amanda said that, you know, just because it's incremental doesn't mean we'll, you know, that at some point we should stop releasing or only do this partial release, right? And that's what I'm worried about if the community is moving towards away from openness and to closed setting, just because one day we suddenly feel there is a threat. And even if there is, it's not going to help, right? Because there's already so much available in the open. And it's so easy to, you know, go look at these ideas and including the blog post and the paper from OpenAI and reproduce this. I think it was Stephen who commented on Twitter about the kind of resources it takes for a bad actor to truly reproduce if they wanted to, and it's not a lot, right? So, you know, so it's not really stopping the bad actors and these malicious use cases because of this, you know, partial release and holding back this full-scale model. But what it's who it's truly hurting are the academic researchers, you know, the students, the junior researchers with the least access to the resources, you know, the marginalized communities, maybe, you know, people across the world where there is less compute infrastructure. I mean, they cannot easily reproduce the results. It'll take them a lot more to go and reproduce and then do further research. So it's hurting the research community a lot more and almost doing nothing to stop the malicious use cases, in my view.
I'd like to interject with a question from a user on YouTube, G23, who asks, you know, would it be possible, and this is asking maybe a bit of a theoretical, but would it be possible to establish some kind of partnership program so that researchers, kind of vetted researchers, could get access to this work without fully making it open? Is that something that OpenAI has considered?
Yeah, so absolutely. And, you know, there's an email address on the blog, the original blog post, where you can suggest both, you know, specific use cases that you're interested in, as well as ideas around, you know, alleviating these trade-offs in terms of access versus limiting misuse. To comment briefly on Anima's point around openness, I totally agree. There are tons of benefits of openness, and it's been, you know, the benefits of openness, if anything, have become more acute to us through this process because it's frustrating, you know, making claims that people are saying, you know, are unsubstantiated and trying to sort of, you know, persuade people that, you know, we're not making this up, that there are actually these capabilities. So it's super, you know, frustrating to have to deal with that trade-off. And, you know, it's quite possible that we made the wrong choice, that, you know, we should have been thinking more. I mean, we did think to some extent, we should have been thinking more about sort of the low compute, you know, sorts of actors, you know, people in developing countries and so forth who, you know, could only get access to this through a pre-trained model. But I think it's also quite plausible. And I hope it's the case that we made the right call and that having a sort of breathing period to have this conversation and start thinking more critically about defenses and coordination around these topics will actually be a net benefit.
I mean, I think we're thinking a lot about these considerations. So things like, are there ways that we can give access to this kind of work to academics who want to work on it, for example? Also, are there ways of interacting like across industry or like, you know, people suggested a kind of partnership? We're interested in exploring all of those ideas. And I think one of the purposes of sort of starting a conversation here was to get a lot of that out on the table and not to say something like, oh, we want to just take action on our own and decide to close things off. The goal was really to start a conversation around this and get feedback, not to say something like, yes, we're just like, we think that we can like prevent misuse by simply closing up research or something like that. That's like not the intention. So just to like earlier points that people made.
Yeah. One of the things that it confused me a little bit about the conversation that as I was following it on Twitter was there seemed to be And it came up in this conversation as well, some suggestion that the models themselves weren't particularly novel. And I guess part of the issue is that we can't really know. But Jeremy Howard, for example, seemed to suggest that the models were, you know, the code is out there to do what OpenAI did. They just did it at a scale that no one has done before. I wonder if anyone has a take on that.
I certainly do, if I can jump in.
Please.
So yeah. Much of the model is really quite the same as OpenAI's previous release of GPT. And the main thing, I kind of refer to these as scale it till it breaks models, where you just take an existing model and you ask a, you know, interesting question, because this is something you can ask with machine learning. If you just keep scaling the model up and keep throwing in more data, does the behavior of the model change substantially? And so that's really the question that the OpenAI team were asking, not necessarily like, you know, we have a new whiz bang model underneath the surface. But because of that, that also does, you know, raise some interesting questions, along with the fact that OpenAI released the code immediately. Because in terms of kind of responsible disclosure for this, anyone can kind of reproduce the research either with their existing code or with previously released code. And I think Anima mentioned, I kind of crunched numbers, it's about $43,000. So it's certainly not cheap, but for, you know, a state actor or someone else like that, or a substantially large company, it's certainly within, you know, their ability to do so. But the model itself hasn't really strongly changed. And so it's more a question of, I guess, capabilities when you scale the models up to this size.
Rob, how about you? Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I'd actually like to go back to the question of limited release as well. So most research institutions have some form of IRB, all in the US do, so ethical review boards, who do exactly this. And so when I was doing my PhD, some of the data I looked at was healthcare messages in the Chichewa language of Malawi. And because they contain PII, I had to go through a review process both here in the USA and then also in Malawi to get approval to use this data, and, you know, I promised to treat it carefully, delete it when I no longer needed it. So a lot of these processes are already in place. People in other scientific disciplines, especially biological and medical ones, routinely have to go through this process. I think that already exists for a lot of AI researchers. And that kind of takes me into the point that I wanted to make, because, to Stephen's point, these models continually get better with more and more data. But we don't have more and more data for most of the world's languages. So I think the way that OpenAI differed from all the other language models that have been released recently is that it really only looked at English. It did some look at novel translation between English and French. But when you look at BERT, a month ago, almost before that, Facebook, just a few weeks ago, BERT and Laser from Facebook had 100 different languages. So English... it's only constitutes 5% of the world's conversations daily. It's the most privileged language in the world. And it's the language for which it's most easy for us to fight fake news right now, because we have AI that can identify fake versus real news. We have teams of people at the different social media companies doing this. For me, rather than fake news or killer robots or other things that your employer might be worried about, OpenAI, it's inclusion in AI, which I think is the biggest ethical problem that we're facing right now. And if these models are only working at a scale that we have for English, then even the software component, the algorithms don't matter. They're not going to be able to be used for 99% of the world's languages. I'm really curious that, if this model won't even work for the majority of the world's languages, where fighting fake news is the hardest right now, because that data simply doesn't exist. Why are we particularly concerned then about the OpenAI English only model compared to others?
Miles, you have a thought on that?
Yeah, please. I mean, yeah. So in terms of the sort of bias question and representativeness around the language, I think that it's definitely something we've considered in addition to other sort of more subtle or non-obvious risks. And, you know, certainly we foregrounded the malicious use risks of sort of people deliberately using this, but that's also something we need to consider in terms of, you know, what is the consequence of releasing these models, and, sort of bias around sex and race is another thing that we've considered as a reason for caution. So You know, that's not to say that we wouldn't, if we had no other concerns besides, you know, the English, you know, bias, would we still release it? I don't know. That's an interesting question. But at the moment,
well, I think a lot of these correlate too. So obviously, like, language and race correlate strongly. But in some cases, the more closely intertwined. So your race through a lot of Latin America is determined more by the language you speak than your actual biological ethnicity. There is a huge gender bias there too. So in a lot of the world, you're more likely to have more education and be taught a privileged language if you're raised male than you are female. So these really do correlate strongly with each other. And also, not to single you out, even though these other models have been released in more languages, that's missing from the evaluations as well. So I think the first model to really get a lot of publicity in the machine learning community was the ELMO model out of the Allen Institute. So they won a best paper award, I think, 2 years ago, maybe last year, at one of the big computational linguistics conferences. They evaluated entity recognition, so identifying the names of, like, people, places, and locations. They evaluated a multilingual data set, which was both English and German. But if you look at their paper, they only have one set of results. And they never say this. You just have to infer that they ignored all the German data and only evaluated on English. And then the BERT paper out of Google did exactly the same. It reported a new state of the art on this data set, which is called a multilingual data set, but reported only the English results. And English and German are basically as closely related as any two languages can be. They're like from the same language family. They're a lot of cognates. And I've played around with the ELMO model, and it doesn't get anywhere near state of the art for this German data set. BERT gets a little bit better, but again, not state of the art. And so I worry a little bit then, you know, to what extent have those researchers or ones at OpenAI, given the imperative of always having state of the art, have they tried this in other languages? Maybe something that's closely related to English as German. They didn't get state-of-the-art results. And as a result, they brushed it under the carpet rather than sharing a really important negative result.
Stephen, what do you have some thoughts on the language issue?
Yeah, so one of the kind of proof of concepts that's in the OpenAI paper, but we've also seen similar strands of research across the community, is kind of twofold. One is that unsupervised language models, substantially help translation. That's kind of an obvious. But in this situation, the OpenAI team were actually purposely stripping out and just retaining just English. And for one of those reasons is that the data sets they were comparing against are primarily English. But they ended up kind of accidentally leaving, I think it was 10 megabytes or so of French in there. And these were kind of like... I wish I knew more French, but like bonjour means hello in English, like as a sentence. And the language model, it does, a reason I mentioned this as a proof of concept, they obviously tried to strip out as much of the language as they could, but ended up with some remaining in there. But even from that small amount, translating from French to English did reasonably well. And there's reasons for that. You know, the language model itself has just been learning what English looks like. And so from even a few examples of French, it can say, well, frequently these go across. The next stage up, which is kind of the broader community, there are many efforts to have, you know, unsupervised translation between languages. And I think you made reference, Rob, to Laser beforehand. And the beautiful thing about this is that by helping, say, translate from English to German, which are very similar, but have, you know, at least a few, I guess, rules in terms of changing around the orders of things or, you know, different ways in which words combine, you can take those same kind of learnings for this model and transfer it to a very resource-low language and still have that transition across. Now, it is a completely fair point that it hasn't worked. The OpenAI team for their language model here hasn't applied it to, you know, further languages. But one thing which I kind of personally have some... This is almost unrelated experience for me. I released a language model sometime back called the AWD-LSTM. The Fast.ai team took it and then have it as a kind of underlying basis. Now it's been immensely modified, but underlying basis originally for the language model ULM fit. And the Fast.ai community have then ported this to dozens of different languages. And kind of the really fun thing for me is I was mainly focused on English. I should probably expand my language modeling vocabulary, even if I don't know the languages myself. But the code that I wrote, because it was general and machine learning does this, transferred very well across these other languages. We have at least seen that the transformer model has been able to do this quite successfully in the past. So I'd expect naively the OpenAI's model to have the same sorts of advantages.
That part's definitely true. So the transformer models have been a lot more successful across languages than the RNN or LSTM based based methods. And then actually, it comes down to the reason that Stephen introduced initially, and that RNN LSTM based models are really only looking at one word at a time and have to pass that memory all the way through, rather than being smarter about finding long distance relationships. And so English is a complete outlier in terms of how important word order is. It's more common in most languages that the subject, the verb, and the object are determined by the suffixes or the prefixes that go in those words, and the words can be in any order. And so this is one of the things that is a little bit problematic about a lot of these results is that testing only on English, which is it's not in the middle, it's an outlier for how important word order is and standardized spellings are and the lack of suffixes, it doesn't really tell you about how well it's going to do more broadly. Certainly the machine translation community, and that's what basically my company right now, the transformer-based methods are really blowing the RNN-based methods out of the water. But that's not so clear in a lot of the language models recently, even if they've been released in multiple languages, only being evaluated in English. And so I think it's representing a real gap in the knowledge that people like me in industry can take from the research community.
So a question I've got for Anima is really about kind of the true capabilities of these types of models. I think, looking at the sample that was released in the blog post, with this model, you can provide a prompt and the output is conditioned on this prompt. And so the prompt was something about scientists discover unicorns, and there's, a rather long and rather coherent text about the backstory of this scientific discovery. It was rather impressive to me. Are you equally impressed? Where do you think this fits in the kind of broad scheme of capability of these types of models? I think that particular example, I think you could argue that it kind of furthers the whole AI boogeyman Terminator thing. It's particularly unexpected, or at least I found it particularly unexpected. Do you think, and we'll ask OpenAI as well, and I think actually to be fair, in the blog post, I said this was, I think they said this was an example that was selected out of 10 or something with that prompt. But to what extent are these types of examples cherry picked? What does it say about kind of where we are in this, the path towards some AI outcome that we don't fear? The thing that we're talking about here that we fear and that we're kind of not disclosing because we fear, how close are we?
And a short answer is, right, I can't really tell without knowing all the details about the model, right, and having access to the model. I mean, any researcher would, I think, comment that as like a one-line answer, right? But more, I guess, importantly, the issue is, like, as you said, not one example. The question of not just how well it's doing on some cherry picked examples, but also what the failure modes were. What did the others look like? Was it completely incoherent, or was it diverse enough? Was it doing the same thing over and over again? I mean, these are all questions we ask for when we try to evaluate the models, right? I mean, we can look at quantitative measures like perplexity, but that's, not enough by itself, right? There is no easy way to evaluate unsupervised learning, right? That's a general philosophical question. What does it mean to have done unsupervised learning well? Because with supervised learning, we have a notion of accuracy. Okay, you get 100% accuracy on your unseen test data set, then you're really amazing, right? But even there are limitations, because you may want to go beyond the test data set and there are further issues. And whereas with unsupervised learning, the question is, what is a good model? When do we say that this, the answer that you obtained that you're happy with, was it because that it was coherent enough, or did you want it to have certain factual reasoning? Did you want it to go through a certain logical set of steps? Right? What would mean it to be impressive? Right? One from a human evaluation perspective, the other from a more quantitative perspective. It is hard to tell, and that's why this is an open research topic that the community thinks a lot about on how to evaluate language models. And that's the reason we need the research community to be very much embedded in discussing this model and getting access to it.
Miles, a reaction to that?
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree that it's much easier to evaluate the capabilities with more access, and it's a very acute trade-off that we're trying to navigate. I mean, one point that Anima raised was that, and you know, it's very much on point, is that it was not obvious what the specific sort of threats we were concerned about were, and you know, and more generally where to draw those lines. So, and you know, this is still something we're thinking through and planning to share more about our process around sort of threat modeling and evaluating these capabilities. But just to get some intuition, you know, first of all, you know, this is not just about GPT-2, but also language models in general. So all of this should be sort of taken with a grain of salt, that we don't know exactly where the biggest threats are and how quickly things will develop from here. But roughly, we have, you know, a few sort of tiers of or, you know, sources of information that we draw on. We look at how things are being used in the wild, like what is actually the situation with fake news, and, you know, where are the bottlenecks in terms of text production and so forth. So that's one set of perspectives, is like, what is the role of, you know, text in society, and what are the defenses against mass produced or misleading text? And then there's sort of in-house analysis, you know, through, you know, both sort of formally doing science as well as informally, you know, allowing people access to the model, including non-experts within the OpenAI organization. So that's where some of the samples came from for the blog post, where sort of non-expert users playing out with an interactive version of the system, as opposed to, you know, like Alec Radford and Jeff Wu trying to come up with the most impressive possible example. So, but it's, we agree that, you know, from the text, it's not obvious that that's the case. Yeah, so in terms of threat modeling, you know, it's important to think about, you know, what can we do in-house? What can we do with a given level of skill, as well as, you know, what would fine-tune variations of the system? You know, we gave the example of Amazon reviews as one example where we've looked at fine-tuning and were able to realize that it was quite tractable. But we're still thinking through, you know, what is the sort of suite of, you know, questions you should ask about powerful language models.
So Anima, a question for you from Connor on YouTube. Maybe pushing back a little bit, do you see any limits with respect to the types of models, or with respect to releasing models? Are there any societal considerations that an AI scientist should make in creating or responsibilities that they bear in releasing their models? Where would you draw the line?
I mean, certainly, I think every scientist should think about societal impacts, right? In any discipline, I think we should all be mindful of the impact we have through the deployment of technologies we release. But at the same time, we need to ask ourselves, if I'm limiting a certain technology, what are the trade-offs? Like, you know, there's both the benefits and the risks in releasing a technology, and we need to do that trade-off. And in the machine learning field, which has been very open until now, most of it is in the open. Right. And even if it's not, it doesn't take a whole lot of resources to get to those capabilities. And so locking it up seems counterproductive to me at this stage, especially in the context of language models and similar research, where so much of it, very similar frameworks, you know, the open source code, they're all available. It doesn't take a lot to reproduce that by bad actors. On the other hand, it can limit access to people in the marginalized communities, people with low, you know, with limited access to resources. So that's why I see in this setting the equation to be more tilted towards release.
I saw a question or response from Miles or Amanda. Which of you is that?
Oh, yeah. it's me in this case. I think one thing that's just worth noting is, like, we are, like, very sensitive to these issues. Like, I agree that it's important that there's, like, equity among researchers, and that one of the downsides of, like, not releasing anything, even just doing a partial release, is that, you know, researchers don't have access to it. You have issues, like, you know, makes it harder to replicate, or at least there's a delay in replication. I think it would be interesting to me, I guess I have two thoughts. One is that we might not even disagree about roughly the weight of all of the considerations here, because I think our position was one of kind of caution, where it's just like, the question isn't something like, do you think this is the exact right moment to do a partial release? But rather something like, are you like, basically, how certain are you that it isn't, or how certain are you, or how confident are you that you're actually on the right side of this scale? And I think that's like the kind of questions that we're asking. And in part, also, I think the thing that this really highlights, you know, when we start bringing up these pros and cons, is the need for like greater discussion of this in the ML community. So in some ways, when there isn't a kind of framework, or there isn't a kind of agreed upon set of norms, or there isn't a partnership on this, each actor is having to kind of think about these issues themselves. And for our part, we were like, well, that means that you have to like take on a lot of caution. And it is important to be cautious, even if you're considering all of the negative consequences of that. So I think it's great that this discussion is happening, but it is also worth noting that this could be made easier if we did potentially have some of these mechanisms to like really help people think through when to release, what to release, and the pros and cons.
Yeah, and how to raise risks in a way that isn't seen or isn't actually, you know, alarmist. So I think one perspective that I think, is worth considering is that the AI community does not have all the answers and is not the only one that needs to know what the technologies coming down the pipeline are. That was sort of where we were coming from with the outreach to journalists prior to the launch. And it's possible that, you know, we could have done more, you know, increase the ratio of researcher, you know, outreach to non-researcher outreach, but, you know, the basic idea is that this is not, you know, just an OpenAI thing or not an AI community thing, but, you know, a more general question of sort of how do we handle these powerful technologies that seem to be coming, even if they're not, you know, totally there yet.
Can you comment on the approach you took to evaluating the kind of the ethical field in the release, the level of kind of rigor or detail? Did you identify, you know, did you have a specific, you know, kind of persona or threat that you were most concerned about, whether it's one that's been stated or unstated, or were you kind of reacting, responding, or anticipating just the broad threat? How did you kind of pursue this?
Yeah, so I think, you know, there are a couple different lenses and we're still not sure what the right lens is. There's sort of, you know, GPT-2 itself and, you know, there's a fine-tuned version. We, you know, part of where we were coming from was seeing what the zero-shot version of GPT-2 was, and that sort of gave us some heuristic evidence that even more powerful capabilities would be possible with fine-tuning or larger models. So, you know, some of it was sort of, you know, anecdotal experiences of people interacting with the model, like Alec and Jeff just sort of seeing impressive things and sort of, you know, a growing number of people interacting with the model, seeing how easy it was to get, human-ish looking outputs, not necessarily, you know, semantically accurate or factually correct to, you know, one of the points that Anima raised earlier, what is the relevant threshold? We thought that it was, you know, we still don't know exactly what the right threshold is, but something about sort of human passable, human-ish text across a very wide range of domains for very little human input.
But this is testable. You know, there's obviously a lot of fake news out there right now. And typical bad actor does this in a really simple way. It's, you know, like templates where you get to drop in certain words and it generates variations of sentences. So, you know, like 100 lines of code, but it's powerful. You have like 10 sentence variants and 10 sentences. You can create billions of different unique paragraphs. And so, you know, it's testable to create a system like that today and then have humans say, you know, which is the more likely to be real. And that's standard, right? Like, how am I compared to the state of the art? And the paper had this. So the paper had a bunch of benchmarks against existing technologies to show they're better than researchers. But the ethical component, or at least everything I've seen so far, has been purely qualitative. And so as the ethics people in OpenAI, do you think you could convince the scientists to drop one academic benchmark and run some new studies which would really demonstrate what the negative impact might be compared to what's already out there?
I mean, I think we're kind of heading in that direction in terms of quantifying the risks of models and things like bias. In the context of language is something that we're starting to be more aware of. And I could imagine, sort of like misuse potential, label for, different sizes of models or something. But I think we're still in the more sort of pre-conceptual framework phase, in the sense that like we know a few considerations, we know a few sort of specific threats, we have some ideas for how to evaluate them, but ultimately, we don't have in-house experts on, everything related to fake news, everything related to cybersecurity, et cetera. So this is very much, a conversation that we welcome input on. So specific ideas for testing the model, specific ideas for sort of threat modeling are super welcome.
I think it's a little interesting that Westein had this discussion about text, which at least I might have an optimistic view, but I feel like the technology is still getting there in terms of the potential, strongest misuse possibilities. And that, a lot of the time misinformation online isn't going to be about writing a long form article that seems reasonable. It's about writing a very short snippet that is terrible in a bunch of ways and then spreading it everywhere. But this type of discussion, we as a community should have really started properly having. Like, we shouldn't be caught in the dark by this as even a question, because, deepfakes has been substantially, to many people, quite destructive to their lives. And for the same sorts of things that powered that, the code that we released, the pre-trained models which have been released, which were then built upon, I feel like we as a community should have had a better response to that. Like, that should have been our awakening moment. And this should be a potential, now we can start considering text modeling through this lens before it's time. I don't know if anyone else has strong thoughts on that.
Do we know where the right forum is for that conversation? I'm not sure that it's Twitter. I mean, Twitter is a part of it, but is it standards bodies? Is it kind of fora at the conferences like NeurIPS and others, or is it some structure that is it regulatory? Is it some structure that hasn't been created? Are there things that we can learn from other technologies that have both beneficial uses and potential for weaponization that, what have they done?
I mean, I think I would be careful in using terms like weaponization, right? Because a lot of, discussions on, especially on Twitter, as you said, it's not the best medium, tends to devolve all the way into nuclear weapons and, those, it's cases of malicious use, right? And this is where there is a lot of, what we saw that I was most disappointed about the whole episode was the media distortion in, wide reaching to the public in so many different countries. The message was, this is so dangerous that this is now locked up, right? That's what the public took away. And that's disappointing, because I think that's a severe distortion from these much more nuanced conversation we are having today, right? This is what we need to be doing. We need to have the dialogue within the community and also with the public. I think there is still a big gap of what they think of as AI or even intelligence. They are not able to truly evaluate how intelligent or how capable the current AI systems are. And I think that's a severe deficiency if we cannot close that gap between the research community and the general public. And that's what worries me the most, that this conversation, we need to present it in a much more balanced form to the public and to the media.
Yeah. I also want to mention, one thing that I always think in my mind, if we think way back when Facebook released a paper that was essentially about two robots bartering, and somehow, I was in Australia and I heard on the nightly news, Facebook AI has taken over something. They had to shut down the experiment.
An experiment so dangerous, they had to shut it down.
Exactly. But that's the thing, right? We have very few chances of reaching this global audience, and we need to be very careful about what ends up stuck in their heads. Because we have the potential to put the right piece of information in someone's head. So they know, maybe to be wary about receiving in the future, receiving that email from grandma, which seems entirely syntactically correct, but she's asking about Bitcoin and has an account already for you to put money into, right? Maybe that's the one piece of information we can somehow impart so worry about in the future. But in the case of the Facebook AI story, I feel like the information that has been locked in people's head is really quite wrong. And Facebook's, they took it on themselves. They wrote a new blog post that explained just how it got distorted within the media. But I can, you know, imagine very strongly that people who saw that television station news segment in Australia are almost never going to read that blog post.
And that's, I think, what I'm more worried about, fake news about AI than AI generating the fake news.
So maybe to start to wrap things up, Miles and Amanda, with the benefit of hindsight, you know, how much you approach this differently?
I'll give Amanda a sec to think about that while I give an easier comment, which is that in terms of venues for keeping the conversation going, we'll be hosting a dinner at iClear for where both policy people and technical people from OpenAI will be happy to discuss and talk about the future of language models generally, not just GPT-2.
Yeah, so I think that ideally being able to have a kind of wide range of inputs from the ML community prior to making a decision like this is going to be very helpful. In the case of media attention, there's a sense in which it's a little bit harder to kind of navigate or control, because the way that something is going to be told, as we've kind of heard, is a little bit more delicate. Although I really sympathize with this, if we could do the, not necessarily just how you do things differently, but how you wish things would go. We were quite positive in the blog post as well. We talked about all of the positive ways that this could be used. And obviously in general, the thing that gets reported is quite negative. And I think that's really unfortunate, because people who are doing ML research are doing it because they want to see, excellent uses of it in the world. And, I think that it wasn't our intention to say something like this research is all bad and you should be afraid of it. Rather just hey, we need to start having a conversation about this. So I think, I would like to see more of that. And I think that it's correct that essentially what I would like to see more of is the kind of nuanced discussion that we're having here, where we're sensitive to all of the pros and cons, both of doing open research and the potential misuse of that research. I think creating forums where people can do that is the thing that I would really like to see going forward.
Yeah, I mean, and I agree with all that. And just in general, both OpenAI and the rest of the AI community need to find ways to smooth this conversation out over time, so it doesn't happen all in, in one, Twitter storm, and sort of, find whether it's sort of, recurring workshops at conferences or whatever to sort of institutionalize this.
How about the rest of you? Stephen, what would you like to see done differently? And what do you hope to see grow out of this scenario?
Yeah, well, I mean, I love language modeling. It's always exciting for me when something comes out. So it's a good thing for me. What I'm going to be interested in is, at some point when I can play with this model, play with other models, you almost always, one of the biggest issues we have in the field is, overfitting. You find ways that these machine learning models learn to cheat in subtle and strange ways. And one of the craziest examples of that is in visual question answering. So you give the machine learning model an image and then you ask it a question to answer. For some time, these visual question answering systems did worse than just looking at the question without ever looking at the image. And the field didn't quite realize it just because they didn't run the right experiments. So that's the thing that I think I'd enjoy playing with. There's the modern version of that for text, which is for a question answering data sets called Squad. Many people were really excited about how intelligent it was, how many of the questions it got correct. But then a group went through and kind of methodically looked at each instance and was like, oh, with a few dozen lines of code and regexes, regular expressions, basically ways to capture certain patterns, you can answer all of these. So it's a question of, okay, this language model is obviously quite good, but exactly how good is it? And, what interesting, strange methods of cheating might it be using that's able to trick all of us at a glance?
Rob?
Yeah, so I repeat what I said earlier, and to speak to Anima's point about making sure the right message gets out there, I felt like, for me, the release wasn't most offensive in terms of what wasn't and what wasn't public. I think the biggest shortcoming was that it was only in English, that it was not diverse, that it was the most privileged language, which correlates with almost every other privileged demographic. That to me was the bigger ethical concern than anything to do with what actually got released in terms of the language model.
Anima?
Yeah. I mean, I think, putting more thought process into you know, collaborating with academia and research community in general, right? And making sure that especially the, you know, researchers with less compute resources are not at a disadvantage. That's something, you know, nonprofit like OpenAI would have a very big role to play, right? To remove the barriers and to truly democratize AI. I think thinking also on that angle, while quantifying the risks and coming up with a more quantitative analysis of risks and also maybe incentive mechanisms, like how to better deploy AI and better release it to the community. These are all things we can, you know, do further research and come up with some best practices for the community, and also best practices in terms of how we talk about this to the general media and how this gets reported. That's something we as a community need to work more about.
Yeah. And, you know, I love the that you're hosting the dinner at iClear, but I'd also love to see, you know, OpenAI kind of roll up its sleeves and help figure out what are the right places to have this conversation more formally, and, you know, who the right people are to bring to the table. A number of the folks that I've commented on YouTube and Twitter about, you know, security researchers have dealt with this kind of issue for a long time. How do we get them into the fold? You know, folks have been doing threat modeling. How do we get them into the fold? There's a lot of work that has to happen to, you know, create, you know, that space and use it to further the conversation. And yeah, I'd love to see more happening there. But for tonight, I'm glad to be part of the, you know, getting this beyond 280 characters a pop. Mm-hmm. And thank all of you for taking the time to jump on and talk about this really important issue.
All right, everyone, that's our show for today. For more information on our guests and the topics covered in this episode, head on over to twimlai.com/talk/234. As always, thanks so much for listening, and catch you next time.